Welcome to The Point. I'm Mindy Todd. Today it's Bird News with Mark Faraday, Science Coordinator at Mass Audubon's Wellfleet Bay Wildlife Sanctuary. Morning, Mark.
Good morning.
866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. I know we've mentioned this before. The ospreys are back. They're everywhere, right? I mean, they're doing really well.
Yes. Too well, some might say. Yeah, so I was looking back at some of the publications and some of the numbers, and back in the 1940s, there was an estimate of about 1,000 pairs of ospreys between Boston and New York. And now, I mean, there's more than that just in Massachusetts. There's probably 500-something pairs on the Cape. I'm trying to figure that out. And I am looking for people to take on the task of doing an inventory for their town. We've got Falmouth covered by the Falmouth Osprey Project. I've got somebody doing Bourne, but I'm due to update my inventory of all the different osprey nests that are out there. And there's been a huge increase. I mean, we see it in Falmouth where Kevin Friel has been doing a careful inventory. And so it went from like 130 nests in Falmouth to 168. In a few years. And so this is real growth. This is population growth, not just nests that we were missing. And so now I'm wondering about the other towns where I haven't really updated the inventory in 10 years. And so who knows, there's 600 pairs on the Cape. And consider that there were one or two pairs in the 1970s, right? That's a that's that exponential growth curve that you get with a with real endangered species recovery. And they're not listed anymore under any Endangered Species Act in the Northeast. They've recovered to an incredible degree. And because we've trained them to nest on human structures, that's what they prefer. And they have really high productivity on these human structures.
Do we have them on both islands? Are they on Nantucket and the Vineyard?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So the Vineyard, is one of those places where we know exactly how many nests there are. And so various people, Rob Beauregard, Gus Ben-David before him. So we know exactly how many, and we're going to do an inventory. Some folks on Nantucket are going to get that going again. I think they sort of lost track of the exact number. I don't know if there's, you know, maybe 40 nests or something on Nantucket, 50 nests, 100-ish or more on the Vineyard, like 100 in the Westport River population. We know really well how many are there. That's that's been monitored for many, many years. We know how many are on the North Shore, but they're all dwarfed by the Cape, just absolutely dwarfed by the population on the Cape because we're big, the amount of coastline. I mean, there are more nests in just Falmouth than there's pretty twice as many nests in Falmouth as in the entirety of the North Shore of Massachusetts. And so it's going to be a challenge to get a handle on it. And I've been kind of, as I'm driving around, I'm trying to get new ones into my database and there might be some old ones we can take out, but for the most part, it's just new. And a lot of them, they're, you know, ending up on power poles and then, those are getting taken down, and so they need to nest somewhere else. They're increasingly nesting in trees, which is good. This is what we want them to be doing. But
now, why do you think Falmouth has so many? What is it about Falmouth? Is it just so much as much water as we have, or you know?
Yeah. It's the amount of shoreline. All you know, Buzzards Bay, the Nantucket Sound, and Buzzards Bay shorelines, the various ponds, herring runs, big freshwater ponds, saltwater, all of that coming together. And then all the poles and all the development. So there's light towers and all kinds of other things, you know,
right.
Walmart parking lots. There are a lot of places for them to nest in addition to all the foraging habitat. And so, I think that's the secret sauce there. There's so many.
So if somebody wanted to help you do that, what did they reach out to you at Mass Audubon?
Yes. Just email, you know, Mass Audubon, Wellfleet Bay. They'll connect you with me. And so, you know, I'm looking for one person per town, but You know, sometimes you have to be careful what you wish for. When you ask for volunteers, you
Yeah.
get a lot, but
Yeah.
I need someone to take on Harwich. You know,
Yeah.
we can divide up Barnstable, you know, because Barnstable's huge,
Right,
divided up
right.
by villages, but we're just due to update my, and again, I already have 500 nests in my database, and I know I'm missing,
You're missing
I don't
some,
know, the
yeah.
real number is what, 30% higher? That's what I want to find out.
That's crazy. All right, well, we also have piping plovers are back, right? What's happening with the
Yes.
piping plovers?
Well, summer's canceled, so the beaches, right? All the
Don't
breathless.
say that because people believe that. You can still
How
walk
can you
on the beach. Just don't bring your
believe it?
dog.
It's so ridiculous. It's just it doesn't really change anything for almost anybody.
I know, but some people think it does. Yeah. Just, yeah.
No,
But
if
you know,
you
but you, but do people still do bring their, you should probably avoid the beaches where the piping plovers are with your dog, right? I mean, the dogs do upset them a
well,
little bit.
yeah, and with a lot of towns, the dog rules have nothing to do with piping plovers. It's the health department. It's the fact that, you know, people see you go on beaches and there's just dog poop everywhere. I see it, the beaches I've managed. But yeah, pay attention to the signs, stay away from areas where the fencing is up because that's protecting plover habitat. But really, like the unless you away from the ORV beaches, right? Like people in the national who like to drive out on the national seashore beaches have to deal with closure later on when the chicks start hatching and July, June, July, then there are closures for ORV beaches.
Right.
But you know, for your average beach either doesn't impact anything or it's just some of the high beaches fenced off in certain places. But yeah, they're back and they're doing great in Massachusetts because of this management, because of managing the driving. There were very few left in the 70s and 80s, and then the protections came into play. Just you know, twine fence around the nesting habitat on the upper beach, and then managing driving so that the chicks aren't getting run over, and that was enough. And so that has brought the population back. I think we've like doubled the recovery goal population for Massachusetts. So they're doing well here. They're not doing as well other parts of the recovery region like New York, New Jersey. They're still struggling down there. So I think as a whole, the Atlantic Coast population isn't at the target levels yet, but we're certainly doing our part here in Massachusetts. And it's nice to see because they belong here. They're it's a sign that we're doing things right. If we can share the beaches with something that was there before we came here, I think that's a sign that we're doing things right.
Yeah.
You know, and people complain and whatever. But o overall, I think it's a success story of balancing human use of beaches with this endangered species needs. They can only nest on beaches. They depend on camouflage. They would get stepped on if we didn't do the fencing. And so whatever small compromises there are, I think this is something that's worked, and we should, you know, feel good about ourselves that we can
Yeah.
protect the beach ecosystem, and we can always do a better job, but we can protect the beach ecosystem. It's not just plovers, it's all these other things, migratory shorebirds, tiger beetles, beach rack invertebrates, like all of this. The beach is an ecosystem. It's not a sandbox. I'm quoting my friend Bob Cook, the former wildlife biologist in the Cape Cod National Seashore. It's a great quote that he had as his email signature. The beach is not a sandbox, it's an ecosystem.
And you know, you think, how would you step on these plovers? But the baby plovers, they're tiny. They are the cutest little things. They look like little cotton balls with toothpick legs, right? I mean, they're
Yeah.
so small, so cute.
There was once a family. You know, I oversee beaches in Truro for the town, and they nest at the Cornhill Beach in Truro. And some family like kayaked into the beach, so maybe they didn't see the fencing, the signs, or whatever, because they didn't walk down the beach. And the kid was chasing a plover chick, and he fell on one and killed it.
Oh
And they didn't. It
no.
wasn't nefarious. They were like, and then they were at an educational display in the National Seashore, and they were like, oh, that's,
Uh-oh.
I think that's the thing that Johnny just killed.
Oh
And they
boy.
sort of confessed, and you know, it was okay, but that's just how vulnerable they are. V
Yeah.
vulnerable, these little cotton balls, and they depend on camouflage, so they'll just like go still in a
In a
footprint
footprint,
or a tire track,
yeah.
right? And then they get into trouble.
Yeah,
So,
yeah.
you know,
So
you
you got to be
just
careful.
have to manage that, and we've done a good job of managing that in Massachusetts in partnership with U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, and you know, places like Nauset Beach, they've made those compromises, the habitat conservation plans that allow trucks to drive out people with ORV permits to drive out a certain number per day. They watch a video. There are people who are kind of babysitting the chicks so they don't get run over. So that allows people to drive out on the beach at the same time that they're unfledged plover chicks. And so, that worked. And the beach buggy folks were part of that. And they worked it out. And so it can be done. And I think Massachusetts is a great example of balancing those uses.
So we have a lot of folks who are, awaiting the arrival of the osprey, and we also have another group who are anxiously awaiting the arrival of the hummingbirds. What have we got, about a week, couple, week
Yes.
or two?
People love that. No one doesn't like hummingbirds. There's
No, not what's in, they're
there's no
adorable.
anti-hummingbird lobby. Yes, so the average person will not see their first hummingbird until May. But when you follow their migration, every year a couple of people report them the middle of April here on the usually on the Cape. And maybe a couple of other places in Massachusetts. And so my computer is telling me it's going to restart against my will. So that'll be fun to that's something I'm going to have to deal with live on the air. So thanks, IT. There's no option for me to delay this. So I'll figure that out at the next break. But yes, and so it's worth having your feeder out for in case you're one of the lucky ones, right? It's like winning the lottery, but some people do get a hummingbird or two in the middle of April. And so any kind of southerly wind is bringing in interesting things. And so early hummingbirds will be on that list. Every April you get some southerly flow and you'll get indigo buntings. And somebody had a prothonotary warbler a couple of days ago in my part in East Harwich where I live. Just they look out at their suet feeder and there's this intense glowing yellow prothonotary warbler, which is a southern warbler that got blown too far north, and there was so you never know. Keep looking at those feeders because there are all these things that come in. And I called it. I last last week's bird report. I was like, we might get some prothonotary warblers. Look out! And then a few days later, somebody had one at their feeder. And so yeah, so things get blown back early. So why not have your feeder out?
So you're saying
Because it's
put the feeders out now, right?
Yeah, why not? Because it's not like it's not going to go bad as quickly as it does in the summer. It's not like you have to change it out every day, the sugar water. You can go a week or whatever without needing to change it. So why not? What do you have to lose?
And look for those hummingbirds. So we haven't seen, nobody's reported one as of yet, though, right?
Well, I don't think so. I haven't seen one. So there's a website that I haven't checked. It's a little early, but there's a website up that is specific to hummingbird migration that I probably should have checked before I went on the air.
It's all right.
But
We'll
yeah, you can
keep
look
our eyes
that up.
open.
It's hummingbird migration, and it's a map, and it shows their northward
Where they're at,
progress by date. And so that gets records that don't make it into eBird, which is what I normally check. Some of the people who report to the hummingbird site aren't birders necessarily. So,
All right,
yeah.
866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org, and we'll have more after a break. You're listening to The Point. It's bird news this morning with Mark Faraday, science coordinator at Mass Audubon's Wellfleet Bay Wildlife Sanctuary. 866-999-4626 is our number for your bird comments, questions, or stories. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. And we're it's during my 40-minute walk at Crane Wildlife Management Area in Falmouth this morning, I heard a cacophony of bird song, blue jay, tufted titmouse, field sparrow, chickadee, cardinal, robin, eastern bluebird, red-winged blackbird, flicker, and mourning dove. I did use Merlin Bird App to help me identify two songs I was not familiar with, the eastern bluebird and the field sparrow. It was interesting how they were pockets of sound, perhaps birds congregating around food sources or certain habitat. Mark has said Merlin does misidentify some bird song, but it does help us novices be more in tune with what we're hearing. That's quite a nice walk.
Yeah, that's a great place. Crane is such a great place. I mean, well-managed early successional habitat like that, meaning it's not a forest, it's grassland, it's shrubland, sorely needed habitats that used to be more of a component of our this kind of Pine Barrens world that we live in here. When back when there were more fires before fire suppression, we had this nice matrix where there were sand plain grasslands and shrublands and all that, and there were heat hens. There was a prairie chicken that was native to
Oh,
here,
right.
and a lot of that's been lost. It's all grown up to be, and a lot of times, a pretty boring monoculture of pitch pines that are now going to need to be thinned out because they're going to get the southern pine beetle. And so these grasslands, like you have at Camp Edwards, the military base does a great job managing for rare and declining species that use these early successional habitats. And Crane is an extension of that, and they're very close together. Huge grassland, so much butterfly weed. If you go there in the summer,
Oh my gosh, yeah.
the wildflowers are incredible. The butterflies, the bees, grasshopper sparrows everywhere. There's grasshopper sparrows basically nowhere else. And so it's such a cool place, and everything listed is expected there. So I think Merlin did a good job. Field sparrows are definitely there, as you'd expect with the habitat. And then bluebirds. Yeah, people don't. The bluebird song is sort of subtle, and I don't think as much as well known as bluebirds are. I don't think the average person really knows what they sound like, because when they sing, you often can't see them. Like they're up at the top of a tree where people don't know what they are and don't notice them. They can't see the color, or they're sitting on wires somewhere. Unless they're sitting on the box and you see them singing, it's just sort of this generic warbly sound. It's a lovely song, but I don't think people know
Yeah.
it so much. So I'm not surprised that somebody needed Merlin
To
to
check
know that
out.
one. And
Yeah.
then Field Sparrow has a great song. It's like this bouncing ball. It's the series of accelerating whistles, and it speeds up. It's like when you drop a ping pong ball, and it sort of speeds up as it bounces.
And the bird song peaks, what, June? Is that when we sort of see the peak of it?
Yes. Well, yeah. The number of breeding species peaks in June because there are some things that don't get back until very end of May, first few days of June, like some of the flycatchers. But yeah, I mean, bird song is intense right now for a lot of the locally nesting species, some of which are already on eggs. I'm sure house finches and things
Yeah.
are already on eggs, mourning doves. Bluebirds are getting ready, tree swallows. But yes, I would say June is when things peak, early June.
Got lots of people on the phone. Let's talk to Bill, who's
Oh,
calling
good.
from Rochester. Hi, Bill.
Hello. I truly enjoy your program. I want you to know that.
Thanks.
But I do have a question for you. I have a situation here. I'll try to explain it as quickly as possible. I have a door, a glass door, and two windows that look out into an herb garden. And since Sunday morning, starting at sunrise, I've had a robin beating at the windows and in the door all day long. And it's happening again today. And I can't understand why.
Okay.
Yeah, it's hard to know what's going on in those tiny little bird brains. Sometimes it's not much. And this is one of those cases. So robins do that, cardinals do it. The classic is the cardinals fighting the reflection in your rearview mirror of your car. But robins are famous for this too, fighting their reflections in windows. And it's not a year-round thing. It's a territorial thing leading up to breeding season. And so there's nothing you can do other than physically barring them from doing it with bird netting or something like that. But it won't last. They're not going to do it for, 3 months. It's just a crazy thing that birds do where they're crazed with hormones and they're not responsible for their actions, I guess, the males in particular.
He thinks there's another bird there in his territory, right? He's like, get
Yeah.
out of here. Yeah.
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 They're fighting their reflections. Yeah, they
Yeah.
think it's another robin.
So, Bill, be patient. It won't last much longer.
All right.
All right. Thanks for
Thank you
the
very
call.
much.
Sure.
And again, I enjoy your program tremendously.
Thanks, Bill.
Thank
All
you.
right. Janet is calling from Martha's Vineyard. Hi, Janet.
Hi, how are you?
Great.
I have a question about nests. Are there any books or illustrations about recognizing bird nests?
That's such a good question. I always wonder the same thing when I find nests in my bushes and trees that I'm like, I wonder who made that nest there.
Yeah, there's a classic book book of bird nests. I'm trying to remember the author. I haven't looked at it in a while, but it's been around a long time and it's been updated and there are others. But yes, it's true that there are nests. there are nests about books. There are books just about how to identify bird nests. And there's one that's in the Peterson series. I don't know if that's, if they took on the classic one. I don't recognize those authors, but yeah, there are different ones, or Eastern ones, Western ones. So yeah, look for those on online.
Yeah, maybe at the library. One of the
Or at,
reference librarians might be
yeah,
able to help you, Janet.
I'm sure Birdwatchers General Store in Orleans would have one or two of the bird nest books.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right, Janet, thanks for the call. John is calling from Edgartown. Hi, John.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
This is great. You guys have a great show going there. My question is more like probably it relates to the fall than the springtime, but migrating birds. Like, I started work back in 2010 in Vineyard Haven, and over the harbor and the lagoon there, I used to see the skies go black with birds. There's so many thousands of them preparing to migrate. But I haven't seen that in quite a few years now. Has the bird population significantly dropped, or am I missing something?
Well, how old are you? Do you remember the passenger pigeons? Or
No.
you don't you don't sound that old. Yeah, you don't hear about the skies going black. I mean, when that happens around here, it's usually tree swallows. And so the big the, and that is a late summer. You know, considered fall migration because they're staging to go south. But tree swallows are the things where your jaw drops around here because there's just so many of them. There could be a flock of 10,000 tree swallows if you hit it right somewhere. It's somewhere like Monomoy or just, you know, the dunes up in Provincetown, certainly on the North Shore, and then the Connecticut River down in Connecticut. There are huge, just massive, tens of sometimes hundreds of thousands in these other places, tree swallows. So I don't know if that's what you're remembering. It's hard to know without more specifics. And that still happens every year. Tree swallows are doing pretty well. You know, some of the sky darkening things like the long-tailed ducks that commute back and forth over the west end of Nantucket in the winter, that phenomenon has really died. And there's just something going on with long-tailed ducks. People who research long-tailed ducks aren't quite sure. Not sure if it's something happening on the breeding grounds or shift in the things they feed on. They feed on like big zooplankton, different kind of midwater shrimps and things like that. So that's a big, very visible decline on one of the islands anyway of a formerly abundant bird. But yeah, I'm not sure what else you might have been seeing darkening the skies. It's a good question.
John, thanks for the call.
I'm not sure what they were, but I was just okay. Great. Thank you.
Thanks, John. Boy, those long-tailed ducks, when they were plentiful many years ago, wow, it's like funnels of smoke going through the sky. I mean, it's just an amazing thing to see. Sad that we
Yeah.
don't see that anymore.
And we still get hundreds of thousands of sea ducks if you, but they're not always that visible. It's they concentrate off Monomoy. And so in the fall, you know, when you add up the eiders and the three species of scoters, sometimes they still look like smoke. I mean, there are just tens of thousands of them flocking across the horizon.
So cool to
When they
see. Yeah.
come in the winter, and it is really cool to see, and it makes you think like, all right, the ocean's still resilient in some respects, and so there might be 500,000 eiders and then similar number of scoters out there, but you kind of need a boat. It's not that visible from shore.
All right. Joe in West Harwich writes, I'm wondering when we can expect the glossy ibis to return to Bell's Neck Conservation in Harwich. Also, the osprey rebound is awesome. The craziest nest location has to be the one on the light pole in the middle of Bud's go-kart track in
Oh,
Harwichport.
yeah.
But do
Oh,
we have
yeah.
any update on eagle nests and specifically what the eagle pair that lost their nest in Orleans during fierce winds in early March? And finally, I've met a lot of people who associate the appearance of male northern cardinals with the spirit of lost loved ones. Any idea why this association seems to exist? So let's start with the glossy. Is it ibis or ibis? I never know how to say that.
Ibis.
Ibis. And
Yeah.
do we know when to expect the return?
Sometime this month and then into May. They're never a common migrant, but there are places like they are easiest to see along the kind of Nantucket Sound side of the Cape in different marshes, like little pocket marshes in Chatham. You might see 10 or 12 glossy ibises in spring. They're around and they like to feed in salt marshes, and they're not as visible as you would think. They're big, it's a wading bird, so they're related to herons and egrets. That big curved bill, that glossy kind of maroonish, reddish plumage. They're really cool birds, but not common anywhere. But at Bell's Neck is a wetland complex in Harwich, with a herring run and saltwater, freshwater impoundments, shorebirds, ducks. It's a great place and gets heavily birded this time of year because it's so full of birds. It's a great place to see them.
All right.
Chatham, but
And then
marshes in Chatham are another good place. So later this month and into May.
All right. And then he asked about the eagle nest, specifically that one in
Yeah.
Orleans. Do we know anything?
Yeah, good question. So we put up a poll in a slightly different, in a little bit of a lower place in hopes that the eagles would then build on that. But they apparently had moved on. Somebody saw them carrying a stick shortly after that alternative pole went up because their original nest fell down. The pole that it was on, everything just fell. And so put up another pole, and that now has ospreys on it. The eagles are still around. Somebody saw the eagles kind of indignantly diving on the ospreys. So they were still imprinted on that island to some extent as their territory, even though they weren't choosing to nest on the new pole. And then someone saw them carrying a stick heading in the other direction away from Town Cove. And so, but I figured if they have a new nest somewhere, the photographers would figure it out. And they haven't, that I know of. They're saying they don't know where those eagles are nesting, and they might take a year off. And as I've said, it's perfectly fine for eagles, ospreys, these big birds that live a long time and nest maybe dozens of times, couple dozen times, in their lifetime. They don't need to nest every year. Their productivity is high. They live a long time. It's not a tragedy if bald eagles take a year off. You want to see, because it's a new thing here on the Cape, right? We only have two nests that we know about. And so we're protective of them, and you want them to be successful. And it was a bummer when that locally known nest pole fell down for the people who had been following it. And yeah, we don't know what they're doing. But so they might have thrown a few sticks somewhere else in a pine tree where it's amazing how well they can hide a nest. As big as their nests are, they can hide them. And it may be that we just haven't found it
Haven't
yet.
found it
So
yet, yeah.
to be determined.
What about the idea that cardinals are loved ones who've passed on? Do you know where that comes from?
I don't feel like I heard this until like the last 10 years, and now it's just I constantly hear it,
Yeah,
and
me too. And I always wondered why cardinals? Yeah.
I don't know. I don't know.
Yeah.
Who knows where that stuff comes from? I haven't looked into it, but whatever.
Yeah.
Whatever people want to think. People I know have said it, and it's fun to do that, and it's not, it's comforting, right? It's terrible to lose loved ones, and it's nice to think that they're coming to check on you, and maybe they are.
Yeah, maybe it's just because cardinals are such pretty birds. I don't know why
Yeah,
cardinals and
right.
not
And
another
no one's
bird,
like,
right? Oh, yeah.
that mourning dove is my uncle. I didn't care for him. I wish he'd stop. That robin banging itself against my window is my annoying brother who passed away. Jeez, he still won't leave me alone. Yeah, you never hear that.
No. Eleanor writes, adjacent to our camp on Lake Tashmoo, until this year, we had a reliable had a nest reliably had a nest of annual occupants. The pole is in this osprey she's talking about. The pole is there, but the nest is gone except for a few sticks. Do osprey remove nests and rebuild it? Could the nest have been deliberately removed? If so, who would we call on the island to find out?
This was a platform, not
It
this
says
wasn't on the power
it,
lines.
it no, it says a pole that it was on a
Yeah.
reliably on this pole. So I don't know what the pole was, but.
Yeah, and unfortunately, that's the information I need. Is it a utility pole or is it a platform? I'm guessing it's a platform because if it was a utility pole, they'd probably figure out that the power company took it down because that's what they do. Not yeah, sometimes they blow down.
Right, the wind.
I've seen a nest where the pole stayed up, but the nest itself got too heavy and shifting to one side and blew down. you know, are the sticks still underneath? It's hard to say, but ospreys are very good at rebuilding. If they want to if everything is still there, meaning the platform and the pole, and all they need to do is rebuild the sticks, they can do that. Nobody needs to do anything, right? Mm-hmm. It's the bird's job to take it from there, right? Like they do the stick part. And so, and if they're motivated to, and they want to continue nesting there, they'll do that quickly. And I think I might have missed I don't know if this happened over the winter or if it was like a more recent thing.
Doesn't say. It just says, they're wondering, if the birds did it or somebody removed it.
Birds in general will use parts of old unused nests to make new nests, but I'm less certain about to what extent ospreys do that because usually they just stick with the same nest.
Right. Maybe add to it a little bit, right?
Right. They add to it, right? Yeah, they don't take it apart and build it somewhere else unless there's a really good reason, I would think.
Yeah. All right. 866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. And we'll talk more after a break. You're listening to The Point. It's Bird News this morning with Mark Faraday, Science Coordinator at Mass Audubon's Wellfleet Bay Wildlife Sanctuary. 866-999-4626 is our number. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. Mark, I did a quick Google search on the reason cardinals are thought to be loved ones. A couple of answers here, which are interesting. It says cardinals are often seen as symbols of lost loved ones because of a popular saying, "When cardinals appear, angels are near," suggesting they are messengers from the afterlife offering comfort and reassurance. And here's another little tidbit. In Native American cultures, cardinals are seen as messengers from the spirit world. They are believed to bring guidance, protection, and comfort to those in need, especially during times of grief and loss. So there you go.
Look at me learning something. I learn new things about birds every day.
All right, let's talk to Carrie, calling us from Chatham. Hi, Carrie.
Hi, how are you?
Great.
A longtime listener, and I love the show.
Thanks.
I have a reference for the earlier caller who was calling about birds' nests. And a number of years ago, a dear friend of mine gave me this book called Avian Architecture by Peter Goodfellow, put out by Princeton University Press. And it's about how birds design, engineer, and build their nest. Oh. And it's wonderfully illustrated and just a great text. So I thought you might be interested.
Yeah, tell us the name again. What is it?
It's Avian Architecture.
Avian Architecture.
How birds design, engineer, and build. And it's by Peter Goodfellow.
Great.
And it's a terrific book.
Awesome.
So I just thought you'd be interested.
Oh, yeah. Thank you, Carrie. Appreciate that. We'll have to check that out. Thanks terrific. For
the Yeah,
for
thanks.
Answer. Yeah, appreciate it.
There's a surprising number of birds
thanks
about nests.
Yeah.
A surprising number of books about bird nests. The classic one I'm thinking of is by Hal Harrison, that's quite old, but is still around and had become part of the Peterson series.
Yeah. All right, great. Thanks. Jonathan's giving us a call. Oh, yeah, thanks, Carrie. Jonathan's giving us a call from Martha's Vineyard. Hi, Jonathan.
Hello, do you hear me?
Yes.
Oh, hi, yes, how are you? I just, I was listening to the osprey pole discussion and the nest and so forth, and it made me remember that, I don't know how many years ago, and it was during the Bass Derby because it was late, it was in the fall, I was walking out to what we call Ganz's Beach. It's on the North Shore by Mink Meadows Golf Course. It's an old couple set of old breakwaters that used to have a cut going into a pond there. But out there on the beach is a pole, a set-up pole with a platform, and there was a nest on it. And I looked up twice, and sticking up out of the nest was an entire badminton racket. So, I said to myself, I know somebody didn't climb up this pole and plant that there. And I just would have loved to have seen the Mr. or Mrs. Osprey, whoever found that thing and flew back to the nest with it. And they must have been so proud. They must have really been proud of themselves.
Yeah.
Yeah, I bet you find all kinds of interesting things in those nests, right?
And so,
Yeah.
bear with me here. You've got two birdies as well. So all you need is a net, and you're good to go.
Whoa. All right. Good
Jonathan,
one. All
thanks for
right.
the call. Eleanor wrote back, and she said this is the question from Tashmu. The pole with platform was erected years ago by either Mass Audubon or Felix Neck. We hadn't been to the camp, excuse me, for 3 months over the winter. I discovered the nest had been removed in early March. So that could have blown down.
Yeah, and Mass Audubon and Felix Neck are the same thing. That's the name of the Mass Audubon Sanctuary there, of course. Yeah.
Right. David in Hyannis says, last Friday, I accidentally killed an osprey. I was flying out of Hyannis in a single-engine airplane. I was climbing out about 200 feet just east of the airport near Willow Street. I saw two osprey wings fully spread, wheeling around. I tried to avoid them, but one struck my wing and was killed. I'm sad about it. My wife wishes to know if there's a chance the other osprey can still find another partner. I hope my wife doesn't feel the same way.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean that this is just what the reality of airports, and this is why airports have to have kind of a zero tolerance policy, because I mean you're lucky you survived that, right? And so first and foremost, it's trying to prevent crashes like the flock of geese downing a m airliner and plane having to land in the Hudson River. Like that's a real problem that airports have to deal with. And so they have kind of draconian permits that allow them to deal with bigger birds so they're not around colliding with airplanes. And so famously, the Snowy Owls of Logan Airport, the solution there is to have Norm Smith for Mass Audubon take them and bring them somewhere else. So they're not, there's always snowy owls at Logan Airport, like no matter how many you in the winter in some years. But he's reducing that risk by taking them and, bringing them down to Duxbury Beach and then later in the winter bringing them north. And so that's a solution that otherwise other airports are shooting snowy owls, right? Because they just can't have them colliding with a plane like this person describes. And so airports have these depredation permits where they can kill birds that other people aren't able to kill under the various Migratory Bird Treaty Act and so on. And so yeah, as to whether they don't really mourn. And so if it was the male you killed, another male will come along in 10 minutes, and I'm sure, so the females don't grieve. They're pretty, they're serious about nesting, and they don't want to miss a year, even though it wouldn't be a big deal if they did. So like the one, this case I described in Orleans, where a male got electrocuted, but he survived, and he went into rehab and came out, I don't know, a couple months later, to find that his wife had quickly moved on and they had another nest somewhere else. His wife. I'm being anthropomorphic, aren't I? But yeah, they move on. And we really have a surplus of ospreys in the area now. So it's terrible. I wouldn't want to see that. I wouldn't want to be part of something like that, but it does happen. And that's an opportunity for another male who otherwise would have been kind of twiddling his thumbs this year.
Yeah, I think David's going, whew. All right. All
Yeah.
right. So you mentioned earlier we've got some birds on, maybe on eggs already, like house finches. And so I'm seeing some, of the songbirds gathering the nesting materials. So when will we start seeing, it'll be another month or so before we might see babies fledging?
Yeah, maybe sooner for some things. I've seen mourning dove eggs in March, and so they could be fledging early. House finches start early. Thing I've been seeing the most recently is, I'm sure other people have noticed this because they're so obvious about it, is crows. Everywhere I look, I see crows carrying sticks, and so obviously this is peak time for them to be building their nests. And our ravens probably already built their nests. They're a little earlier. Every town has nesting ravens, whether you know it or not. They're
Wow, really? Every town? I didn't know
oh, every
that.
town on the Cape has nest for years now. And there
Wow.
was 15 years ago, there were almost none. And then they started nesting at the down at the canal power plant, on the
I
power
remember
plant.
that.
And then they've just exploded, and they nest on cell towers and in trees, and water towers are one of their favorite things. Like it seems like just about every water tower has a raven nest if you inspect it. Town hall in Provincetown, years ago. They've tried that a couple different times. Ravens building a nest on Town Hall in downtown
Wow.
Provincetown. And so, yeah, they're not shy. They've gone full suburban and urban even really. Just in 20 years, a complete change, a shift in behavior and population, just like that. But yeah, the crows are really building heavily now, and yeah, it's that time. I mean, things are changing so quickly. In April, Phoebes came back at the beginning of the month, like just overnight. The pair of Phoebes, the Eastern Phoebes, this adorable flycatcher that I named my daughter after. They're very tough. The birds that come back in April are pretty tough, and Phoebes come back sometimes in late March and early April. Even though they're primarily insectivores, and they get down to business. And more things are coming. Golden Crown kinglets are coming through really heavily right now. They came through heavily in the fall, early winter. These are tiny birds that nest in northern coniferous forest. They're tiniest songbirds we have, but they're tough as nails, and they can winter in really cold places. But they came through in late fall, early winter, and now they're heading back north again. And so it went from zero kinglets, golden crown kinglets, a month ago to now I'm hearing them everywhere I go. So that's one of those subtle April migrants that if you can't hear them, or they have these really high-pitched little songs and calls, you wouldn't necessarily notice. And then hermit thrushes will be coming through, flickers, juncos are starting, they're going to start heading back north, and then others will be passing through. So we're in the thick of April migration. It's not as noticeable as spring mig as I'm sorry, May migration, when it really gets nice and a lot of the colorful songbirds come back and the warblers and things. Yellow rump warblers are coming through right now, and they're starting to molt. I had a couple at my feeders today. So so songbirds are migrating right now. I know this was originally a question about nesting, and I
Yeah,
sort of got off
no.
track,
I was
but
going to ask about the what's
yeah.
migrating. So that's moving right into my next question.
All right. Anticipating your every need,
That's
Mindy.
right. we have the rare early spring overshoot migrants like the swallowtail kites, right?
Right. I touched on one of those that showed up a couple of days ago in Harwich. And so there are these birds that, some of them will pass through here eventually. Like they're more of a May migrant, like an indigo bunting. And anyone who's had the experience of seeing a male indigo bunting under your feeders in spring, because in the winter they're brown, it's just an incredible looking bird. I mean, it's just a work of art, that intense shiny blue. And some of those might come up early in May, but then there are others that don't nest this far north. It's a true overshoot where they were just trying to get to South Carolina and somehow ended up in Harwich. And so that's like a Prothonotary warbler. It's very much a warbler of southern, southeastern swamps, cavity nesting warbler, pretty interesting, just absolutely gorgeous. And then the yellow-throated warbler that somebody may, I think, still has at their feeder in Dennis, somewhere, I don't know, east of Fallins Pond, somewhere, one of those dense neighborhoods. Somebody's got a yellow-throated warbler, another southeastern bird. Beautiful warbler that has no business being here. That one showed up in March. And then the swallowtail kites, it's just crazy. And so there are a bunch of March records of this bird that was coming back from South America trying to get to, I don't know, North Florida, Georgia, at the most, and then somehow ended up here. And it's just been happening more and more, and some of them have stuck, they stick around now, and they're a summer resident in a part of the Upper Cape, from like South Sandwich, east of Mashpee Wakeby Pond, down to Osterville, Kitiwit, Mashpee, where there are just swallow-tailed kite sightings spring into summer. And it's just a real head scratcher, because they really are birds that nest in Florida, Georgia, Brazil, Peru. Overall, they're mostly a South American bird that just gets into the warmer southeastern states. And then here they are now, a summer resident in this part of the Upper Cape. It's one of the big mysteries for us
Yeah,
birders and
used to be
ornithologists. Like,
really unusual to see one, right? And
yeah, right. But you would get these overshoots that show up at a hawk watch, but it seems to be increasing, and now there are these ones that are staying, that are raising these questions. And them showing up in March makes no sense. It's too early for that. There's such a wimpy bird. It makes no sense. I mean, look at this weather.
And it's just,
it's just
cold.
Been so
yeah.
dreary, and the wetness yeah. makes it feel so cold. It's just, and there's no end in sight. And so, you know, they eat insects on the wing to some extent. In addition, they eat everything. You know, they'll pick snakes and things out of trees, lizards. Mm. We don't really have snakes and lizards in trees around right. here, certainly not in March. And so they have to, I don't know, figure out how to pick chipmunks and squirrels out of trees.
Yeah,
I
maybe
guess.
They're waiting for the cicadas.
Oh, they would do.
Right? Because
oh,
the cicadas.
They would
do
so well with the cicadas.
I mean,
that's right.
17-year cicada coming soon.
They would gobble those up because yeah. they're a hawk that loves to eat. I mean, hawks will eat anything, most of them, except ospreys who, you know, really just do fish. But the others are just have a very Catholic diet, as mm-hmm. as we say, and they would yeah love to take advantage of all those big juicy cicadas.
Yeah, all right. And so last few minutes that we have, tell us about some of the shorebirds we should be keeping an eye out for. I like the oyster
right.
catchers. There, you can really spot them with their orange legs. They're easy to pick out.
Oh, they're fantastic, right? They're just appeal to all the senses, I guess. I don't know. I don't know what they smell or taste like. I shouldn't say that. They appeal to a couple of the senses, let's say. So they're very bright and contrasty and big and loud. And they're not on every beach, but they've been increasing. They're, you'll see most of them in Chatham and some of the islands. They like islands. They're a little more afraid of people, quite a bit more afraid of people than piping plovers are. So they're not going to be nesting on a busy beach like a piping plover will. They need to be out on a secluded marsh island or something like that. We have them, they nest on Tern Island in Chatham, which we, Mass Audubon owns and we manage. And Chatham's a great place to see them. There are tons of them around Monomoy. But yeah, just, and they come back a little bit before the piping plovers. So they've been coming back for a while now. Greater yellow legs are back. Like if you go, we were talking about West Harwich Conservation Area or mm-hmm. Bell's Neck Conservation Area there in West Harwich. And so, you know, there are greater yellow legs there that come through in April. People have seen a couple of pectoral sandpipers, which is less common, but it's a long distance migrant that winters in South America and is on its way back to the Arctic. We might start seeing lease sandpipers. And then you never, and then we get rare things in the spring. Mostly we see rare shorebirds in the southbound migration in the summer, but in, we get them in the spring too. And so this black-necked stilt has been around wherever that came from. Hmm. It's just a crazy looking long pink legs, hence the name, black and white tuxedo plumage, long bill, you know, much bigger than our other sandpipers. And there was one in P-Town for a while. And now maybe the same bird is in North Chatham, going around to different wetlands there as recently as yesterday. It's, and so you never know. But yeah. by the end of the month and into May, we'll start getting the shorebirds are in breeding plumage. And so that we don't get as many shorebirds coming through in spring. We just don't. They either go straight up the middle of the country or they fly over us heading straight to the Arctic. But the ones we get, the ruddy turnstones, the Dunlin, the black-bellied plovers, the sanderlings, are in breeding plumage when we see them in May. And so that's something to look forward to because, you know, they're kind of drab looking when mm-hmm. we get them in the big numbers in late summer through fall and some of them into winter. So it's nice to see those shorebirds yeah. in breeding plumage. So that's something to look forward to.
They're all dressed up looking for a party. All right. Mark
that's
Faraday's
right.
science coordinator at Mass Audubon's Wellfleet Bay Wildlife Sanctuary joins us the second Tuesday of every month. Thanks, Mark.
All right, catch you next time.
I'm Mindy Todd. Thanks for listening.
Point is produced by Amy Vince. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Production assistance from Jenny Junker and Dan Tridle. Theme music by Benjamin Verdery and William Coulter.